And this is the final presentation, and it's a great pleasure to be able to introduce Ulisse and Antonella, who've come from Rome to be with us. I haven't told Martin this yet, but they're very happy to think of organizing a meeting for us in Rome. And so I imagine there'd be a lot of interest of people here to come to Rome. Anyway, we'll talk about that later and keep you posted. This is the book that they have written recently, and which you may have seen. I reviewed it in the last issue, and this was one of the reasons for inviting them to come today. And they were explaining a little bit about syntropy and the origins of syntropy, and this sort of neglected dimension of our understanding of reality, which is what they're going to talk about. And you can see how the whole issue of retrocausality, which we've been talking a little bit about, its implications, you know, can contribute to the discussion on the nature of time, the nature of free will, and the nature of precognition. What they've also been doing is working with the Pear Laboratory in Princeton. So this book is actually published by Brenda Dunn and Bob John in the series of their books. And it's a lovely book, and they do have some copies here afterwards if you want to get a signed one at the end of the session. Anyway, their title is Syntropy and the Attraction of Love, A Possible Explanation of Non-Locality and Retrocausality. How about that for a title? And you're very, very welcome. I'm looking forward to your presentation.
Thank you, David.
Grazie. We have decided that I'll do the presentation because we have 45 minutes, right? And then we'll answer together the questions, me and Antonella. But it is a shared work. We are both working on this topic. Now, I start with a small question. You certainly know this equation, I suppose. Do you know who belongs to this equation? A name?
Einstein.
Okay. Well, it is not exactly that way, because it had been published before by an Englishman in 1890, Oliver Heaviside, in the third volume of his electromagnetic theory, then by Poincaré in 1900, and in 1903 it was published by Olinto de Preto and registered, patented this equation at the Regio Istituto delle Scienze. And the father of Olinto de Preto was a very good friend of the father of Albert Einstein, and it seems that this is the way how this equation got to Einstein. But there were big problems with this equation because it didn't keep track of the movement of bodies. So it was very difficult to generalize this equation among different reference systems. And what Einstein did in special relativity, he added momentum, which is that P, in the equation, and he got the energy momentum mass equation. But in order to do this, the equation had to become a double order equation. So when we need to find the solution of energy, we need to use a square root. And as everyone knows, square roots always have two solutions, one positive and one negative. And that creates a lot of problems in physics. For example, when you have a mathematical function, the negative solution of square roots is discharged automatically, because otherwise you would have non-deterministic functions. You would be placed in front of a choice, either to go left or right. And, looking at this equation, Einstein could not just reject the negative solution of energy, because this is one of the fundamental equations in physics. But at the same time, he could not accept the implications, because the positive solution has positive time, it's energy that diverges forward in time, whereas the energy solution of energy has a negative time, and it is energy diverging backward in time. And when he saw this dual solution, he said, well, the positive solution is the physical solution. The negative backward in time solution, for Einstein, it was God's causality. And he said, we cannot have God causality in physics. And the way he devised to remove this backward in time solution from the equations was to say that the momentum is so small because physical systems, they move in such a slow way compared to the speed of light that the momentum could be considered neglectable. And removing the momentum, you go back to the classical equation with only a positive solution. But in 1925, Wolfgang Pauli found that electrons have a spin. And this spin is very fast. It nears the speed of light. And that means that in quantum mechanics, you cannot use the E equal mc square equation, but you have to use the full energy momentum mass equation with a dual solution, a positive time and a negative time solution. In 1926, two physicists, Klein and Gordon, they combined the energy momentum mass equation with the wave equation in quantum mechanics, and they got an equation that had advanced waves and retarded waves, and but it was considered to be outrageous, the idea of waves and energy flowing backward in time. Heisenberg, who was a very, say, charismatic physicist, he had a very strong personality, he said, I regard the backward in time solution as learned trash, which no one can take seriously. Well, the year after, Dirac, in 1927, he tried to solve this mess of the backward in time solution, applying the energy momentum mass equation to the equation of the electron, and he was sure that the negative solution, time solution, was not going to show up. But he got the electron and the positron in his equation, and the positron, according to the equations, moves backward in time, and it was found to exist. In 1932, another physicist found that positrons exist, and so it was not really so easy to discard this solution because there was evidence about it, but it was, in a way, discarded the idea that the positron was moving backward in time. So there was a big, big conflict in the 1920s and 1930s about this dual solution in the fundamental equations. And at the end, Heisenberg won. And from 1934, no one ever talked again in physics about retrocausality, also, even though it was in the equations. But in 1941, a mathematician that few people know, his name is Luigi Fantapier, he was an Italian mathematician, died in 1956. He was one of the foremost mathematicians of last century. He graduated at the age of 21 from the most exclusive Italian university. At the age of 27, he was already a full professor. He worked 1 year in Germany with Heisenberg and Schrödinger, and in 1950, Oppenheimer invited him to become a member of the Institute for Advanced Studies and work together with Einstein. Well, Fantapier said, I'm not a physicist. I'm a mathematician. I cannot accept that physicists just reject half of the solutions of the fundamental equations because they don't know what to do with them. I want to understand what they mean, so I started working from a mathematical point of view on the dual solution, and what he got is that the positive in time solution, energy diverging from a cause, for example, you have light diverging from a light bulb, heat diverging from a heater, well, it is governed by a law that we every one of us knows that it's the law of entropy. So you have concentrated energy that just disperses in the environment. But the negative time solution works in a different way, because instead of dispersing energy, it concentrates energy. While concentrating energy, you have an increase of differentiation of complexity. You have an increase of structure and order. Unlisting the mathematical properties of the backward in time solution, he was obtaining exactly the properties of life. So he wrote in 1941 a small little book named The Unitary Theory of the Physical and Biological World, where he says the physical world is governed by the positive in time solution, the biological world is governed by the negative in time solution. So according to Fantapier, we are retrocausal systems. The magic, the mystery of life is because causality works in a different way. It's not forward in time causality, but it's backward in time causality. Now, this has huge implications. A lot of other people in the same period were working on similar ideas. One was Teilhard de Chardin, that I suppose many of you know. Teilhard de Chardin was a paleontologist. It's a difficult term to pronounce, but he said, well, in paleontology, I'm not able to see Darwin's law of evolution. What I see is that species, they move like in tracks, and they are attracted by attractors, by final causes. So he introduced the idea that there are final causes, that he named the last final cause. There was a kind of hierarchy of these attractors. It's the omega point, and all life is converging towards this omega point, which is, in different words, is the same theory of syntropy. But what Teilhard did, he said, well, you know, if this is true, God acts from the future and not from the past. And so we should read the Genesis backward in time and not forward in time. He was also a Jesuit priest, and his books were banned by the Catholic Church. But at the same time, also, Fantapier's theory on syntropy was banned, because even if he was one of the foremost mathematicians, no one was able to find any paper on syntropy. It was like if, you know, in a way, something was happening and not allowing this theory to become known. But if this theory is correct, then thermodynamics works in a different way. We have now three laws of thermodynamics. One says that energy cannot be created or destroyed, it can only be transformed. The other one says that energy goes from the availability of energy to the, say, dispersion of energy, so it's not any more available after some time. And because of this, the third law says that the universe is evolving towards heat death. It will just, everything will destroy, we will not have anything more. But if it is true, the law of syntropy, then we have to add another principle that says that there is also something that leads energy to concentrate, and another principle that says that there is not only a principle of death, but also a principle of life. And so life is one of the laws of the universe. It's not just coincidence or chance. But the problem with this theory, I'll say something before. It's we get a design where the world, the universe, is divided in causality and retrocausality, and according to equations, retrocausality is not just a little thing. It's half of the universe works according to retrocausality, and half works according to causality. And causality is diverging. spiritual causality is converging. So when you have attractors, you're really dealing with retro causality. And with causality, we can... I don't know why it does this. But with causality, we can have information, transmit information. With retro causality, something different happens because we can... the idea is that attractors are, in a way, select what it is advantageous for life. And this information is then shared to all the living systems that are connected to this attractor. So what someone else is doing, it will affect me, but it will affect me going through the attractor. And slowly the attractors start having information about the design, the shape, and this information is spread to everyone that is connected to this attractor. And that can explain why you see in life this, say, species tend to be very... the English word... what? Converging and stable, because with Darwin's theory, you would have a huge instability in species. And the other interesting thing is that these two types of causality work in symmetrical ways. For example, when you use forward-in-time causality, if you want to have a very strong effect, you have to put a very strong cause. With retrocausality, when you want to have a very strong effect, you have to reduce the cause to the minimal level. The smaller is the cause, the biggest is the effect that you get. And now, the problem with this theory was that the experimental method can only test forward-in-time causality. So Fantapier and all the other people working on this idea, they didn't know how to experimentally give a proof of this theory. Well, in physics, other people have been working on retrocausality. Some had their ideas came from Fantapier, even if they didn't make the name of Fantapier. But, for example, Feynman, with the quantum electrodynamics that introduced uses backward-in-time causality, he used to correspond with Fantapier. At the beginning, he said, oh, I don't believe to your ideas, and then he turned it into quantum electrodynamics, but there is not one word on what on this kind of correspondence with Fantapier. But the problem in physics is that when you set up the experiments, you really don't know if causality is moving forward or backward, so you could have both interpretations. It is different when you work with living systems. Now, Antonella, she did a PhD on this theory, and the PhD was in setting up experiments that could prove this retrocausal idea of syntropy. Now, the hypothesis was, if life is sustained by syntropy, by this backward in time flow of energy, the parameters of the systems that support living functions, that is the autonomic nervous system, should react in advance to stimuli. So what we were expecting is that the heart rate and the skin conductance would react in before stimuli, and especially emotional stimuli. We tried very different type of trials, like using black and white figures and so on. And at the end, the one that was giving best results was using colors. The trial was very simple. The person had to look at these colors on the screen. Each color was on the screen for 4 seconds. Then he was asked to try to guess what the computer would have shown later. And after the guess, a random generating, diciamo, process was used to select the color. So there was no way for the person to know what the color that the computer would have shown in the last phase of the trial. Well, the heart rate was measured during all the experiment, and each person had to repeat this trial 100 times. So we could also do data analysis within each subject. And what we get is that heart rate differences should vary around the baseline. Instead, in most people, we observe heart rate differences which diverge from the baseline, and it's not just statistically significant, it's also quantitative strong, because we get a 2 heart rate increase or decrease from what would be the baseline. And each person, the problem with this is that each person has his footprint here. It's different. You have some people that have an increase in the heart rate when the target will be red. Other people have a decrease in the heart rate when it will be red. So what it is interesting is that if you put all together this data of all the different people, you tend to get a null result in the differences, because someone increases, someone reduces the heart rate, and then you get a mean value. And it is very important, I'll spend some words about statistics at the end, because one of the big problems in science is that we use statistical techniques based on the study of differences that in a way imply forward causality. So the experimental method and the statistical techniques that are used are not really the best to study retrocausality. Well, this was Antonella's work. She did several different experiments, many different controls, because obviously the reaction was not positive. Until it is a theory, until it is a philosophy, no one tells you anything. But when you start having experimental data, they don't like it. So they started telling Antonella, oh, you're cheating, you're lying, oh, we don't want to look at the data. It's impossible. No, this data is impossible. And they were trying to kick her away from the PhD, saying it's... But they didn't manage, and a big conflict started in the faculty of psychology, and also she had a tutor from quantum physics that was following her. And at the end, when the National Commission came to examine her work, they couldn't say anything against the work that she had done, but no one of her faculty and tutor was present at the discussion. They were just frightened about, in a way, supporting the idea of retrocausality. And what we have discovered, there is a dogma, a very strong dogma, that causality can only move forward. When you start talking about retrocausality, something happens. You lose your grants, you're not able to publish, and so everyone was frightened to support Antonella's work. Now, the idea that we get, the design that we get, and this was suggested by Chris King, that is a mathematician from New Zealand, is that if we have information coming from the past, and it is visible information because causes in the past can be seen, and it can be processed by the brain. And if we have information coming from the future that, according to the experiments and to the theory, is emotional information, we can feel it, but we cannot see it, our brain cannot see this information in the future, well, we are always in between having to choose what our head is telling us on the base of our experience and what the heart is pointing to. And so we are always in between these two options. And according to Chris King, free will would arise from this constant state of choice. And so the other idea is that part of the world is visible and another part of the world is invisible. Like consciousness is invisible, but we all feel conscious. We feel that we have this feeling of life. This something that we're not able to touch, but it's very real. And according to this theory, consciousness is not a product of complexity of the brain or material systems, but it's a product of this backward inflow process that is linked to syntropy and to attractors. So even the smallest life forms would feel that they exist. They might not be able to think about it, but they have a feeling of life. Now, following these ideas, we get that the mind should be divided on three levels. The conscious mind, which is linked to free will, to the fact that we have to decide which direction we have to follow. So free will would be a basic property of life. It's not, you know, a byproduct of something else. And our unconscious level, because our autonomic nervous system is constantly providing information to our body on what to do, how to do it, how to mend the skin, how to digest. And this unconscious level is linked to automated processes, but there is also a superconscious level which is linked to the attractor, to what provides us with syntropy. And as I was telling before, these attractors in a way are intelligent. The information converges towards them and they relay the information to all the individuals. So in a way we can get intuition, inspiration, and we can see we can feel the future through this superconscious level. And this superconscious we can access, according to this theory, this superconscious level of mind through our, say, autonomic nervous system, our heart area. And our heart area would be a key point, a key element in providing a meaning and a direction to our personal life. Now, you know, one of the problems with this theory is that time is treated in a very different way from how we perceive it. According to the energy momentum mass equation, there should be three levels of time. One, it is what we are accustomed to, which is causal time, that is time moving forward, and it would be typical of diverging system, like our universe is diverging, and so our universe is governed by forward in time causation and by entropy. But in systems that are converging systems, like black holes, retrocausal time, backward in time, flow of energy would be dominant, and that is the reason why you don't see matter coming out from a black hole, because when it gets in, it goes backward in time, it vanishes from our time frame. And then there is another type of time, which is the supercausal time, which when you have a system where diverging and converging forces are balanced, both causal time and retrocausal time would coexist, and there would be a unitary time where these two polarities can converge together. And this is the level of the quantum physics. In Greece, in old times, they used to say that time was divided in chronos, kairos, and aion, which is the same division that we find in this model. But now the problem is this. If syntropy is available at the quantum level and entropy instead governs the macroscopic level, how does syntropy flow from the quantum level to the macro level, which mean allows syntropy to move from the micro to the macro level? Well, in, I don't know if it was 1925 or when, but Pauli discovered that in the water molecule, the hydrogen atom is in between the quantum and the macro level. And he discovered what we now know called the hydrogen bonding, which is a key element in life, in DNA, and so on. And so the idea is that water is the mean that allows syntropy to flow from the quantum level to the macro level, and that would be the reason why we are mainly made of water. Now, if you see the properties of water, they're just symmetrical from the properties of other liquids. For example, when a liquid solidifies, it gets cold, well, the, say, cold part, the matter part, start forming from the bottom. Instead, in water, it starts forming from the top. And all the properties of water are just symmetrical. Water absorbs a huge quantity of energy. Other liquids don't absorb this huge quantity of energy, and that would be a property of syntropy, which converges energy. And water creates structures, very complex structures that you can see in snow crystals. So the idea is that we live in an entropic physical world, and syntropy is provided by the quantum level, and water provides the mean that lets syntropy move from the quantum level to the macro level. Well, if this hypothesis is true, it can explain homeopathy, because, you know, homeopathy works with water. Remedies are made of water. And the idea of homeopathy, sorry that I have difficulties in pronouncing these difficult words, is that if you want to have a strong effect, you have to reduce the active substance to the point that it's not there anymore. And it's exactly how retrocausality works, because if you want to have a strong effect using retrocausality, you have to reduce to the least possible level the cause, the retrocausal, say, activation. And probably the reason why classical science rejects homeopathy, or it says it's not scientific because we cannot see the cause, is just because the cause is backward in time causality. And backward in time causality needs water to function. And this could be an explanation of homeopathy, and I've been working a bit on these ideas. Well, many different authors have, in different ways, introduced the idea of attractors and producing some very interesting hypotheses. But each one of them had difficulties in publishing these ideas in mainstream journals. It seems like if you move away from classical causality, you're banned from mainstream. Even if you're supported by strong experimental data, like, for example, the works by Bem and Dean Radin, only Bem managed to publish on mainstream, and that was really... The reactions were violent about this paper published by Bem on mainstream. And so there is a science that is developing outside of mainstream science, which does not agree on the dogma of forward-in-time causality. And the mechanistic, materialistic paradigm, according to this type of science, does nothing more than increasing entropy. The big crisis we are in now in the West would be a consequence of focusing only on forward-in-time causality. Now, one interesting point about entropy and syntropy is that they are complementary, they're not opposite. Even if entropy leads to death and syntropy leads to life, if you see to the equations, energy is a unity, and energy can be entropic, dispersed, or it can be syntropic, it can be converged. And if one goes down, the other one goes up, and vice versa. Now, the problem is that syntropy, it is invisible, and entropy is visible. But this mechanism, the fact that they are complementary, allows to work on syntropy, working through the material world on the entropic level. What many scientists have always seen is that there is a kind of paradox between life and the physical laws that are governed by entropy. Schrödinger said, well, living systems maintain their organization and order, feeding on negative energy. This process is essential for the survival of living systems. Since Gheorghe, syntropy explains the quality of organization and order of living systems. So there is a conflict between life and entropy, and this conflict, in a way, has interested me a lot, because just think about our vital needs. We need to eat, we need to acquire energy, but that is because we are affected by entropy. Entropy destroys our organism, it depletes our energy, and we need to replenish what entropy destroys. But at the same time, well, these are material needs that everyone knows, and we have these needs because of entropy, because we have to cope with entropy. When we satisfy these needs, well, we feel well-being, but when they are not satisfied, we have alarm bells that start triggering, like we start feeling cold or thirst, and we need to eat. We have pain that tells us that we're not meeting these needs. But at the same time, this model says that we have also some other vital needs which are invisible but as important as material needs. One is that we need to acquire syntropy in our organism. And as we said before, syntropy converges, and we can feel it in our, thorax area. So when we, in a way, when we are acquiring syntropy, this backward in time energy, we feel well-being and warmth in this area that usually we call it love, this kind of feeling. But when we're not acquiring syntropy, we start feeling void and pain in this area of the body that most people name anxiety, angst, anguish. And these are just alarm bells telling us that we're on the wrong track, that we need to change our path in order that we can acquire syntropy. And it's like if we have a compass inside ourselves that tells us which is the direction that we have to follow. If it is an advantageous direction, if it goes towards the tractor, we experience well-being and we experience love. If it diverges, we feel pain and suffering. So pain and suffering will be extremely important, because they tell us, they inform us that we are on the wrong track. And the other point is that syntropy is converging, so consciousness would be felt very limited in space. Our feeling of self is very localized, very limited. But the universe, the physical universe, because of entropy, diverges. It goes towards infinite. When we compare ourselves to the universe, we realize that we are equal to zero. And so we have a conflict between the fact that we perceive that we exist, we feel we exist, and the fact that we are aware that we are equal to nothing. And this conflict would be a basic conflict in all, say, human beings, and it's felt as being meaningless, depressed, And so we have alarm bells that are telling us, oh, you have to provide a meaning to your life. The famous phrase is to be or not to be. That is would be one of the key problems of every one of us. Me, you, and I suppose everyone here has a vital need for meaning. What we usually do is that in order to cope with this vital need for meaning, we try either to increase the numerator. For example, we try to get meaning from outside, from other people's judgment, from world's popularity, power, or we try to reduce the denominator, like we close ourselves in a community, in a sect, or we can even reject the outside world. And also only our inner world exists. And here you have a lot of psychiatric disorders that come out. And but the identity conflict equation says that the only way to solve the conflict between to be or not to be is to unite ourselves to the universe. And that is why we talk about love, because the end aim of life of human beings would be to unite with the rest of the universe, and that can be only done through this cohesive force that is, we call it syntropy, Teilhard named omega, or we can call it love. Now, in this moment, we live in an era which is dominated by the identity conflict. The polarities of entropy and syntropy are divided, so we're in full duality, and this is felt with as a crisis, as strong feelings of pain, and so on. The aim of, say, this model suggests that we have to move to a non-dual reality where these two polarities merge together and work together. And we call this the theorem of love, this second system. Now, getting to the end of the presentation, because I think I don't have a lot of time, is I want to say again about the complementary between entropy and syntropy. So if I pull down entropy, syntropy automatically rises up. And this provides a lot of incredible tool to work on the life of people or with organizations and any system, because it's very easy to reduce the entropy of a system. And then syntropy automatically goes up. And life is continually trying to reduce entropy and to increase syntropy. This can be maybe defined a law of life. Life constantly tries to reduce entropy and to increase syntropy. And this has always known in history. The interplay of these two different forces can be found in any philosophy and religion. Like, for example, you have Shiva and Shakti, one destroys and one constructs, but they are always playing together. They're not never separated. Yin and Yang, one is diverging and one is converging, but they are united together. And there is this representation of Jung and Pauli that I find interesting, where they were saying, well, you have causality on the left in the past, and you have synchronicity in the future. Synchronicity is retrocausal. It's something that is acting from the future, and we see things happening together like coincidences, but they have a meaningful direction. And so what happens when you reduce entropy and syntropy starts raising up? Synchronicities start showing. And so you start having very advantageous opportunities coming up. And a lot of training can be done in this direction. Now, I was saying, but how do we do science in this field? Because the problem is that on one side, we have quantitative, objective information, causes, and visible. On the other side, we have qualitative and subjective information. We have feelings, emotions, the invisible. And there is a split in mathematics and statistics that really mathematics and parametric statistics applies to this left side of entropy and quantitative information. Whereas when you have to work with syntropy and retrocausality, you inevitably have to get into non-parametric statistics. And I've been working a lot on that, producing software in the non-parametric statistics and providing support to researchers, even not telling them why non-parametric statistics, because, you know, if you have to tell a theory like this, maybe they would say, oh, no, we don't want to use your techniques. But they're very happy when we do data analysis. You can use a huge number of variables, qualitative and quantitative, together, put them together, and do a type of science that is, you know, accepted, because that is, say, statistics. It's, you know, there is no problem with those techniques. But in a way, they have in them this idea of causality and retrocausality. And now, about this methodology, there is a book in Kindle that you can download, which is the methodology of concomitant variations, and also a software that can be downloaded freely. And then we have this book that we that David told you about, that we have published with the ICRL. We have some copies here, so if someone is interested, you're welcome to get it. And we're happy if someone gets it, so we get some space in our luggage to take something back from London. Okay. And this is the presentation. And now we're open to questions.
Thank you very much indeed. I think you'll agree that this was a mind-expanding, model-expanding presentation, which I think is very exciting and has interesting parallels, which I might bring up a little later on. So I'll just make one preliminary observation, and that is that it struck me that there are parallels in what you've been talking about with two other thinkers. One is Victor Schauberger, and his work on water, because he talks about the implosion and the explosion, and the fact that we've concentrated on the explosive type of technology rather than the converging type, and there's all sorts of implications to that. And then the second person occurred to me, and some of you will have read my reviews of this, is Walter Russell. Walter Russell talks about the unfolding and enfolding process, And one associated with the building up and the other with breaking down, or the movement from the center outwards and the movement from the periphery inwards. And so there's a sort of reversibility of principle which applies at all these different levels. And his book, The Secret of Light, explains that. I think I reviewed it in the summer 2 years ago. And then also the Universal One. And if you want a really small introduction, then it's The Man Who Tapped the Secrets of the Universe by Glenn Clark, and you can actually get that on a PDF. Your talk reminded me of these sort of parallels. Of trying to complete the picture, but we may only have a part of the picture. Anyway, let's go. It's Tuvi and Janine on the starting blocks. They're at the front here, and then we'll go to goodness.
Thank you very much, both for the wonderful presentation and also for all the research that they're doing, which is wonderful. And I believe that this type of science should be the part of the future science which is missing. That's first.
Thanks.
And just a few, again, comments. I'll start with something very, very simple. In English, there is one word for ask for cause, which is why. And why, people think in English, is something in the past that caused it. In Hebrew, there is two different words. One is similar to why in English. what caused it, but another one, what is the purpose of this? And it's two different questions. So if I ask, for example, a scientist, why this building is here, the simple scientific explanation from entropy or from what happened, that was builders who came here and put bricks and put the windows, and this is why the window is, this is the only cause. But if you ask somebody else, he say, of course, because there was some person who saw this area, thought it would be very good to have a conference here. And he took an architect, and now look at the process now. The process was exactly from future. So they decide what will be in the future, and then they thought it would take about 3 years to do it. So this plan of what happened 3 years was an attractor to attract the builders and the engineers and everything to create this building here. So if you think about this, exactly the process of attractors, that's this in the beginning, like blueprint of the building, was the cause of this building here. So you can see the two causes, one of the builders and one, and the same principle that that the person who owns this place decide to do it, is happening not just with human being, because if you think every plan that human being is work exactly on the same principle, but also the universe. When you look at evolution, it's exactly the same process. Marilyn described about the randomness, so it's a combination of randomness, but then there is if the, all the mutation was only random, you cannot develop such sophisticated things like ice and all this. In order to develop, because the mutation is, the chance is so tiny to have something positive, so you need tiny, it's the probabilities, it's not the probability of the times the universe. So the only thing, if there is attractors to make the life to the animals want, or some consciousness want to, with this entropy, to take them with attractors, to the, then they develop. And when you look at nature, you can see all the development all the time. So it can't be just random process, it's also entropy at the same time.
Thank you. Can we try and keep the questions short? Because there are an awful lot of people trying to ask questions. And
I'll be very short. We have been working a lot with in the field of economics and management with this idea, because classical management is based on past causes and cost-benefit analysis and so on. But then you discover that very good managers, they're very intuitive. Yeah. They follow these inner feelings. And so the problem was, why? What are these inner feelings? And when you see that there are attractors in the future, that we can feel them, then a very good manager is someone that is able to feel these attractors and take the organization this direction. And the purpose is to do training in such a way that people can feel these attractors.
So you need both intuition and rationality. It's Jackie, and then Janine.
I'm delighted to see how your concept brings together so many disciplines, but I have two specific questions. One is that at this conference we've had presented a number of studies, particularly by Professors Mealy and Zilberstein, that were, the evidence was capable of interpretation as precognition. Would you say that these studies would in fact be explicable in terms of your concept of retrocausality?
Yes.
That's one question. My second question refers to the concept of entropy and the conventional answer, of course, to entropy at the macro level is the idea of, well, not the idea, but no doubt the accepted fact of dark matter and dark energy, which, of course, prevent the dissipation of the universe. My question is whether syntropy alone would actually do that, or probably not. And how do you see dark matter and dark energy as fitting into your scheme of things?
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, this is a very good question. You know, not all physicists agree on dark matter and dark energy. One interesting group in Spain has put forward the idea that I totally agree with, is that when you have a diverging system, the Big Bang, time flows very fast at the beginning. Then slowly gravitation starts slowing the diverging forces, and then time starts slowing down. And when it goes back to converging, time starts flowing back. Now, the problem is that when you do the observation at the, say, cosmological level, you see that the rate of the increase of the universe is speeding the universe. So you need some element like dark energy to say, why is the universe speeding this diverging process? Well, the answer might be that it's not speeding, but it's slowing down. But because time is slowing down, at the same time, we perceive that the rate of inflation of the universe is increasing, but it is not increasing. It is decreasing because time is slowing down. And so all this discussion about dark matter and dark energy might be just a need to explain something that you're not able to explain at the cosmological level if you don't introduce syntropy. If you introduce syntropy, there might be no need at the cosmological level for dark energy and dark matter. That is one point. The other point is about precognition. I was telling someone that last month I gave a seminar to a firm in California, and what the problem with this backward in time flow of information is that you have feelings that move backward in time. You don't have information that moves backward in time. So you have feelings with no information. Your heart attracts you in a way, but it doesn't tell you why you have to go that way. So it's a bit doing an act of faith to follow your heart. But several people have discovered that they can use this mechanism to acquire, with, say, a level of uncertainty, information from the future. For example, this group based in California, they use a very simple picture. They have a Tour Eiffel picture. They know exactly where it will be placed, and it will be placed straight or upside down. Now, you have a certain number of people, like seven people, that they try to guess how the picture will be put the day after, if it will be straight or upside down. Now, what they get is that the rate of guessing correctly is around 70%. It's not at 50%. And so what they decided to do, and they're making a lot of money out of it, is according to how the stock exchange market goes, they set the picture straight or back down, and they have the information the day before with a margin of error, and they invest their money in the stock exchange following this. But they could see that it works, but they didn't have any theory explaining why it works. And syntropy, in a way, provides this idea. So in a way, precognition, I would talk more about presentiment, because we feel, but in a way we can have precognition, we can have a certain amount of information with a big uncertainty in it that is linked to feelings. Would you agree?
Yes.
Okay.
Janine.
Hello. Thank you very much. I'm here.
I was looking.
I loved your presentation, and I really feel a lot of attraction towards this fantastic model. There was just one little thing that I didn't understand, and you may have partially answered it in the previous answer to your question, which is, in one of the slides, I think you had black holes as being some kind of evidence of syntropy, but black holes are in the physical universe. So I just wondered how that worked. I didn't quite understand how that could be evidence of syntropy.
Now, one of the evidences of syntropy is gravity. You know, physicists don't know what gravity is. They know it exists because we all experience, but no one knows what gravity is. Now, according to this model, half of the forces are diverging and half are converging. And converging forces would work retrocausally. So the idea of this theory is not only based on biology, but it's a physical, a mathematical physical theory. It suggests that gravity is a retrocausal force. is a diverging force acting from the future. And if this is correct, gravity should propagate instantaneously. Now, if you ask 20 physicists, which is the speed of propagation of gravity, they would say, oh, well, it cannot propagate at a speed faster than light, because that is the limit. But if the syntropy theory is correct, the propagation speed of gravity should be instantaneous. And now, when you do experiments, for example, in eclipses, you know that light takes 8 minutes to propagate from the sun to Earth, so you would expect that the gravitation of the sun would take 8 minutes to reach Earth. But when you do experiments with eclipses and you measure the peak of the attraction of the combined mass of the moon and the sun, you get that the peak is exactly in the moment when the two objects are aligned. So there is no delay in the propagation of gravity. And that would tell you that gravity is a retrocausal force, moves backward in time. So, in a way, this is a theory that combines physical reality with biological reality, because they're part of the same universe. You don't have to keep them separate.
It's Michael, and then the next one's going to Claudia, that one.
Thank you very much.
Michael, then Peter.
When people talk about retrocausality, there are at least two very different models, one of which is misleadingly, I think, called retrocausality. Because if you think of nature having a kind of nisus, or drive within it, to what would complete it, then it's not a case of what is in the future driving what is in the present, but a complex appreciation of what's emerging in the present, drawn by what would complete it. When Aristotle talks about final causality, it's that. And when we talk about the architect, for example, it's not really the future dragging the present, because the idea in the architect's mind is present now. It's not future events. It's something in the present. Now, I'm not ruling out retrocausality in either sense, but it's also possible to think of a kind of emergent drive, or what Aristotle called a telos, within the structure of the universe at the Big Bang, driving it without the future as such, but with a nisus within it now. And these two aspects need to be distinguished.
Well, I think that we agree in what you're saying. And one of the reasons why we agree in what you say, and it doesn't really dismiss what we're been talking here, is that when you talk of retrocausality, you're talking about it because time is unitary. Past, present, and future coexist. So that is really the weird thing. It's not that the future is there, the past is there, and the present is here. They're all together. And yes. Maybe...
The idea is that at that level, there is a continuous present. So unitary time. So we agree with you that we don't need the idea of future events. Everything is in now, here and now, yes. Continuous present.
Well, Antonella, she's a hypnotherapist, Ericksonian hypnotherapist. And when you do hypnosis, you get into this unitary time. You can in a way, act on the past of the person, but act on it as if it is still present, but also act on the future. And that provides you incredible opportunities of, say, tools of change of the person that you're working with. Mm-hmm. Is it correct or not?
Yeah. Yes, but apart from hypnosis, another technique which is quite effective in order to learn how to get in contact with attractors is the concentration on heartbeat. If you want to have a try, you can just sit down, legs crossed or on a chair, and put all your concentration on heartbeat. You can also put the hand on the chest, maybe will take a while to learn how to feel the heartbeat because we are not trained to listen to our hearts. But if we do that every day, 5 minutes at the beginning, then we can go on with longer session, amazing things happen. This attraction we are talking about, you can feel it inside you. So you really feel an attraction, something that attracts you from the inside. So it's the heart that attracts you. And at a certain point, you start feeling a sentiment, which is love. So it's amazing because you feel love from inside yourself. So you don't need any more love from outside. You don't need a love from partner or from your parents.
You don't need my love?
Yes, yeah, I still do, yes, yeah.
Thank you.
But the amazing thing is that you can feel love from inside yourself, and that is existence, life that talks to you and attracts you into another dimension, another reality. So if you want, you can try this simple technique, concentration on the heart. So you can also, when your eyes closed, you can imagine to look at the center of your chest. This permits concentration of energy in this point. And just let it go. Do not resist to what is going to happen. And it's difficult because we always need to control, to know what's going on. We have expectations, we have desires. Just let go. And really magical things will happen.
Thank you. I'm going to take Peter and Claudia, and then we're going to have a slight break, but we've got more time. We've got another half an hour. No, stop. I can't just... No, I'm sorry, but I'm just trying to... I can't include everybody. We've got about 15 people who want to speak. I'm sorry, we have Claudia behind you.
Well, but we can answer...
Al would like to come in, so I'd like to take Al as the first one of the wider panel, which Peter will be chairing in a minute. So there is more time for questions, but this has obviously been so stimulating that there are hundreds of questions, and I can't include everybody at the same time.
One thing that I wanted to say, there is our website, and through this website you can have access to several books, among which one is a novel. This theory described as a novel. Jerry has read it and she liked it a lot. Few people have read it at the moment. And so we can keep in touch. You can read what we have produced, and there is a journal with a lot of papers, and we can answer to your questions by mail or probably organize other type of events, like in Rome.
Okay, yes, come to Rome. So let's do that. There's last two quick ones, and then we'll have a change of order, as it were. So Peter, then and Claudia, and then we'll have more time in a moment.
Okay, just two quick points and two quick questions for you. It seems to me that if one sees the body as a balanced system between these two, then there will be changes in what you perceive according to how you alter the balance.
Yes.
And as you come up to death, then you are losing the causality part, and therefore there should be evidence as you're dying that you go into love and synchronicity and light and so on, and the data is absolutely there to support that.
Yes.
So that is a wonderful prediction of it. The other one is that if you go through a period of training, you can then change the way the body is, but it's got to be training of the body, and the heart, and the brain to produce a
syntropic
force.
Yes.
Not so much force as emphasis. Then you come into absolutely non-duality. This is the body states, and I've changed it from mental states, the body states of non-dual experience. And people who are locked in non-duality are, in fact, pushed over onto that side. Are those two observations correct?
Totally correct. One thing we've been working on, and it's more of the field of Antonella, is about death. Because the idea is that, you know, when you follow this idea, you don't believe that death is the end, but it's just a transition. And our evolution towards the attractors will require many lives. And we move from our entropic world to the syntropic world, that is the afterlife. And in the afterlife, it's very easy to see which is your mission of life, your purpose, your attractor. And so people that usually have had pre-death experiences, they come out totally transformed. But you can experience those pre-death experiences also near death. But you can do it also through hypnosis. Like you can, with hypnosis, times become unitary. You can move backward in time to, say, your eventual previous life, and move forward and re-experience death and the period between lives. And when you do that without having to die, you find that your life has a meaning and a purpose, and it is very transformative.
And this really is what drug effects do too, so I can see it working exactly the same
yes.
way.
Thank you. Quick one from Claudia, and then we must move
sure.
on.
Thank you so much. It's been fantastic. Yeah. And in quite a lot of what you mentioned in terms of the attractors and so on, I notice that an important element is the role of imagination. And I wondered if you could say a little bit about the role of imagination in the human process of moving from entropy to syntropy and attractors and so on.
Do you want to?
Yes, but... So you mean visual imagery, imagination, visualization?
Yeah, I don't mean fantasy. I mean imagination, which is so much part of our creative process and the
yes.
way in which...
Yes. I can answer from the point of view of my practice with patients. I'm a psychotherapist. I'm trying to teach people to get in contact with their hearts, which is the real self, the true self inside us. Visualization and imagination, they're powerful tools, but at first we need to get in contact with sensations, because the problem is that when we visualize, when we imagine, the mind gets control of the process, and we lose contact with the sensation of the heart, which are very sharp and precise. I think that there is a problem with, for example, with guided meditations when there is someone suggesting too many images, no? So it's the problem, the risk is that we step into an imagery world, and we are taken away from sensations. And the sensations we experience in the heart are a kind of teaching, because when we were born, the first heartbeat pulse manifested inside the heart. From that moment on, our existence is connected with the intelligence, with the knowledge of nature. So if we want to go back to our real nature, our true self, we have to look inside ourselves to this point. But this point it doesn't have images or visualizations. It just has sensations. So I think that visualization is a powerful tool, but we can use it after we have become familiar with sensations. That's my opinion, because I've seen many, many people entrapped into imagery, and they lose the possibility, the capability to get in contact with sensations, with the body, with the feelings, with the heat, the warmth we feel during this practice. And that's a big risk, because it's when you have been practicing for years, guided meditations, for example, it's very hard to unlearn what you have been doing for so long a time. So that's the risk in my practice, in my opinion.
Thank you.
Good, but after some times.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm not going to say anything more at this point, but I'd just like you to join me in thanking Antonella and Ulisi for a fascinating presentation. Thank you.